Welcome to episode 43 of the Steptoe Cyber Law Podcast, brought to you by Steptoe & Johnson. Thank you for joining us. We're lawyers talking about technology, security, privacy, and government. And I'm joined today by a great group, Michael Vadas, formerly with the FBI and the Justice Department, now a partner in Steptoe's New York office. Jason Weinstein, formerly with the Justice Department, where he oversaw criminal computer crime prosecutions, among other things, and is now doing criminal and civil litigation at Steptoe. Markham Erickson, we're pleased to have here, a partner in our telecom, internet, and media practice in Steptoe's D.C. office. And our guest for the day is Ambassador Daniel Sepulveda, the Deputy Assistant Secretary of State and U.S. Coordinator for International Communications and Information Policy. Did you have to take a pay cut to get a title that long? That's so remarkable. But he is an ambassador in the State Department's Bureau of Economic and Business Affairs. Danny and I go back, he may not want to admit this, to his work for an obscure single-term senator on the immigration reform legislation in the Bush administration, where I was representing the administration and Danny was representing, who was that guy? Barack Obama, that's it. Yeah, he was. Both of us, I noticed, have bailed on immigration as fast as we possibly could. And I certainly think I'm better for having escaped. I don't know about you. And I'm Stuart Baker, formerly with the NSA and DHS and record holder for returning to Steptoe to practice law more times than any other lawyer. So let's get started. This week in NSA, the USA Freedom Act is showing signs of life. I don't think it's more than a twitch, but maybe it's more than that. Harry Reid said to Senator Leahy, who's the principal proponent of the USA Freedom Act, that he would send USA Freedom to the floor of the Senate and pursue passage. That's obviously a good sign for passage in the lame duck, but I'm still pretty skeptical that it's going to pass. Senator Feinstein has already said she opposes the judiciary written bill, as you might expect, since it's a real intrusion on her Intelligence Committee's jurisdiction. And Senator Cornyn has expressed pretty serious doubts about the bill, and since he's going to be a prominent member of the Judiciary Committee majority next year, his doubts are going to carry some weight. So, and then finally, even if it does pass the Senate, there's a different bill that has passed the House, and somebody's got to give. I think it's possible that the House would give just to take the issue off their plates, but there's 100 ways this could go wrong, and only one way it's going to pass. So my guess is, as always in Washington, you can't go wrong betting against legislation that doesn't have to pass. I noticed that Ben Rhodes, the Deputy National Security Advisor, came back from trade talks with China and talked about having raised cyber issues with the Chinese in the course of getting agreement on a trade deal, which suggests to me that after spending a year and a half in a bunker dodging Snowden complaints, that the administration has begun or has revived the pressure that it was trying to build against Chinese espionage just before Snowden blew up. It's not clear that the Chinese are reacting particularly well to it, but that there is at least some sort of effort to try to get the Chinese to step back in their cyber espionage campaign. Okay. One of the other things that I thought we ought to do is launch a new feature called The Law Behind the Headlines, where we talk a little bit about what the legal background is for some of the big tech stories. And that's especially true since some of the big tech stories are all about how evil the government is and how lawless in gathering information. So I picked out a couple of stories that I thought might be fun to dig into. One of them is this story where Insicam, which I assume is Insecure Camera, has begun live streaming feeds from surveillance videos owned by individuals or by governments around the world, and the streams are all basically derived from compromises of cameras that have been bought by somebody, put on the internet, but are protected only by the default password and login credentials. So somebody has gone to the trouble of logging into thousands of cameras and is now live streaming them on the internet. You might find yourself on those cameras, maybe a camera you own. And my question, maybe Jason, you know the answer, is this just the world's biggest confession to a felony, or actually 11,000 felonies? It's hard to believe this guy isn't violating the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act by hacking into these or defaulting into these security cameras.
It's a good opportunity to plug the criminal defense part of my practice.
yes.
Because it seems to be a pretty clear, at least there's an argument made, it's a clear CFA violation. You know, just because you made a password easy to guess, or in this case didn't change a password that is unbelievably easy to guess, doesn't mean that there's not a password, and doesn't make your access to the information into the computer that's represented by the camera any less unauthorized. And it may violate other statutes as well, depending on the circumstances and what exactly was being obtained besides just the video footage. I suppose that Insicam and the people behind it would say that their motives were pure, to sort of raise awareness of the importance of having strong security settings, and while that's an admirable goal, it's hard not to question the purity of their motives when they're also providing location information for the people whose cameras are being...
They've got little Google Maps so you can see exactly where they are, and some of these things are in people's homes, right? They're basically their nursery camera.
Right, exactly. Their kids sleeping in their beds, or people, you know, watching TV or doing whatever they do in the living rooms. I think there will... The story will not end with the fact that they have done this to raise people's awareness. If you're one of the people whose footage has been hijacked, all you have to do is change your password, and they won't be able to get access to it anymore. But I think they will, they'll be hearing from the government at some point.
So, and if you are one of the people who runs the website, that's Jason Weinstein. You want to give your phone number? Okay.
Do you think, is the fact that you can just change the password going to affect the ability to bring a civil action against them?
It's still an unauthorized access.
How are you going to claim $5,000 in damages?
If you spend $5,000 trying to figure out who did it, you might be able to do that. Although, usually it's $5,000 to figure out how to clean your system. In this case, that's a matter of 20 minutes of internet research. I think that's probably right.
I suspect you'll see people resorting to state law claims that might give rise to civil suits.
It's trespass.
Yeah, trespass.
Sort of, exactly. Yeah. So I think that the two people who benefit from this story will be the criminal defense lawyers who represent Insicam, and the class action plaintiffs lawyers who will sue them.
I'm pretty sure that the guys running Insicam don't have enough resources to be worth a class action lawsuit. Okay, well, so that was fun. Here's the other technology story that's gotten surprisingly little legal analysis. It's flying dirt boxes. The story, which was in the Wall Street Journal, that was a little vague on the details, but it appears that the Marshals Service, at least, and perhaps others, have been flying little Cessnas over metropolitan areas, pretending to be cell towers, and people's phones will connect to them if they have the strongest signal and provide some basic information. Here's my number, here's my ID, here's my location. And if you're trying to find somebody who has skipped out on an appearance, or you just want to pursue somebody who's perhaps on parole and locate them, this provides very detailed, very granular location information. But to do it, you have to collect lots of people. Since you're the strongest signal in the sky, everybody's phone wants to connect to you. And that means you are gathering some information about, you know, everybody in the metropolitan area, potentially. Shock and horror has been expressed by the usual suspects. But one of my questions is, what's the legal basis for gathering that information? How much judicial supervision, how much of a case do you have to make to fly these things? And they're not just, there are flying dirt boxes, there are also on-the-ground dirt boxes, according to the press, called stingrays, that are used by local law enforcement as well as the feds to locate people without flying over the area. Michael, Jason, what is this legally controversial?
Well, you know, the Wall Street Journal article leaves out details that I think are critical to the legal questions. One, it doesn't say what sort of court order the authorities are getting. Could be a search warrant or could just be a 2703D order. If they're collecting location information, then I would hope they're getting a search warrant, because if they're not, then I think there is going to be more legal problems with this. It's also not clear if they're actually...
Just push on that first? That's a matter of policy for the Justice Department, so they'll be in trouble from a policy point of view. Some courts have not said that it's a violation to gather that information without a warrant. And if these guys happen to be parolees, I don't know if the Marshal Service goes looking for parolees who've disappeared, but their Fourth Amendment rights are remarkably limited, aren't they?
Well, it's easier to establish probable cause if you're looking for a fugitive than, for example, you're looking for a person who's a suspect in a crime. But just to add to what Mike said, because so much is unknown about what the way these devices work, from the description of the Wall Street Journal, it sounds like an airborne stingray. And a stingray, the Justice Department has traditionally argued, is legally the equivalent of a pen register, which doesn't even require the same standard as a D order or the probable cause that a warrant would require. All that a pen register requires is that the government certify that the information is relevant material to a criminal investigation. And that's legally quite a low bar, although the way it's interpreted in different districts is different. You know, in New York, when I was an AUSA there, I used to be able to get a pen register basically by, you know, treating the application like it was a Mad Lib and filling in the number I wanted. In Maryland, I would have to write 15 pages single-spaced of facts only to be told that it wasn't enough. Mm-hmm. So different judges interpret the requirement differently. To the extent it's obtaining location information, as Michael said, you might need a D order or you might need a warrant. It's probably, though, whether you're talking about pen register, D order, or warrant, not very difficult for the government to meet the standard, especially in a case where the person you're looking for has absconded and, you know, is an old school fugitive who's been convicted and is on the run. The question is, and this is where some of the controversy over stingrays has come into play when you're talking about actual stingrays, ground-based stingrays, is whether the government has been fully forthcoming with the court about how the devices work and how much data from innocent people, non-suspects, is going to be collected, how that data is going to be handled and disposed of. And there have been allegations by the usual suspects you're referring to in the stingray cases that the government is not being forthcoming with the courts. That's based, I think, not necessarily on fact, because these orders are often obtained, if not almost always obtained, in circumstances where they're under seal. And so the only people who know what the government said are the court and the government. And so as long as...
And interestingly, there's no phone company that could, at least in theory, object to this.
Well, you're taking the phone company out of the equation.
Right.
So as long as the legal standard, whether it's the ones that Mike mentioned or the one that I mentioned, is being met, and as long as the government is being fully forthcoming with the court about how it's collecting and disposing of the data of people other than the suspect, there shouldn't legally be a controversy here. Although, you know, the same usual suspects in the journal immediately started comparing this to the NSA bulk collection of phone records, which is different on levels too many to mention. You're getting a court order in advance based on individualized suspicion for a suspect. And as long as the government is being truthful with the court knows what it's buying into when it signs the order, there shouldn't be a controversy. But until we know what the government was asking for and how it was explaining how the device would be used, we can't answer those questions.
Yeah, although to stick up for NSA on this, in many ways it is very similar to what NSA did. That is to say, you're looking for particular people. You can't look for those people without collecting large numbers of connections. And your defense is, people connect to our system, but we discard that. We don't even look at it. We don't even see them because they're not the number we're looking for. There's no harm if nobody looked at it, which is NSA's argument. They say, yes, we collected communications on everybody in the United States, and we looked at 300 people's calls. You ought to focus on the fact that we only looked at 300 rather than the fact that we collected all the data on everybody. And that is essentially what the defense is going to be, that, yes, your phone connected to us, and we saw that you were connected to us, or the machine did, and it said, that's not the droid I'm looking for, literally, discarded it, and so it shouldn't even be treated as a seizure.
See, I think the better analogy to this is a straight-up subpoena for toll records for a suspect's cell phone. When a prosecutor gets issues a subpoena to a phone company and gets toll records for, say, 6 months for a suspect's cell phone, they get all of the calls the suspect has made.
Right.
And that includes calls to the doctor and the psychiatrist and the kid's teacher and the grocery store and the baseball coach. It includes every call the person's made. Not, you can't just say to the phone company, send me only the calls with the criminals. And
well, you don't know if the baseball coach is involved.
Right. But Jason, that is sort of within the trap and trace context, and if it is collecting location information, it does feel different than that kind of
thing. Sure. And because it's collecting, you know, this is on a much larger scale, to be sure, and the fact that it's collecting so much data at the same time, and the data is so much more precise, you know, it's one thing to know that you called, you know, an innocent person 6 months ago on your cell phone at 1:55 in the afternoon. I don't know anything else about that call, but if I know where the innocent person was at this moment in time, it feels different, and it is different.
That's why it feels much different than trap and trace. Although I will say, if the drone or the Cessna is up there and able to fix the fact that I'm in a dead spot with my wireless provider and will retransmit that, I will be happy to give up my Fourth Amendment concern in exchange for that.
A little extra service. I think that's right. They're giving back to the community.
That's why I think Michael's right, that it likely is a deorder or a warrant. And so the critical question is, what's the government doing with the data that it's not intending to collect? And is it disposing of that data immediately, which is what it should be doing?
And it's pretty easy to set to program it to only look for certain numbers. I have to say, there's some schadenfreude for the Justice Department, but in the wake of Snowden revelations, which were treated as a great scandal, there's a whole bunch of people who want to treat all law enforcement bulk collection of any sort as a great scandal, and they're trying out all of these stories on the American people. And I think at the end of the day, with a little luck, there'll be a gradual understanding among the population that, you know, what NSA did isn't that far off of what law enforcement does every day. It's a carrying to a logical extreme of law and investigative techniques that have been used by the government for a long time.
Yeah, I don't know that my glass, which is normally half full, is quite that full, but I do, as you guys have probably gotten tired of me venting about this on the broadcast, that the government agencies that will be most affected by Snowden are going to be domestic law enforcement agencies.
Oh, yeah, and it's killing them. It's got to be killing them.
And it's, you know, they had nothing to do with this, and the way they operate is very different, at least in terms of how they obtain legal authority and the timing of obtaining that authority, and yet they're being painted with the same brush. And I think that you're right that, you know, sort of the usual suspects are sort of testing the fence to see where they can make inroads against domestic law enforcement too. But at some point, I'm hopeful that people will understand that there is a fundamental difference between putting aside the legality and propriety of the NSA. That's irrelevant to the discussion. That there is a fundamental difference between individualized suspicion that causes you to seek judicial authorization in advance of taking action and doing it after the fact or in a way that involves any of the concerns people raised.
Well, we certainly, by the time another location case goes to the court, there's going to be lots of litigation and lots of public data about the many ways in which location is used by law enforcement, and that's going to make it harder for them to assume they can just make a casual determination that location is somehow different and needs special protection. But we'll see. Speaking of good news about bad law, the Kaczynski opinion in the Innocence of Muslims case is going to en banc, or at least That's what it looks like. This is the case where the Ninth Circuit panel kind of more or less made up a copyright interest by an actress who said, I was lied to when I signed the release, therefore I still have a copyright in my performance, and I want my performance taken off the internet because it could get me killed. And everybody understands, you know, the risk of getting killed is something that ought to be taken seriously, but inventing a copyright interest, it seems to me, was always a dumb idea, and looks like the Ninth Circuit is going to take another look at that. I don't know, Markham, if you followed that case.
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, there are two significant pieces here. One was the Ninth Circuit took the unusual step when they granted the en banc of also saying that their prior decision is not cannot be used as precedent. So
there's a signal.
there is a signal. And, you know, I think it was pretty clear that Judge Kaczynski in the first ruling, this was a bad facts make bad law, and was hoping to sort of have a one-off opinion because he felt bad for Garcia. And indeed, one should. She was tricked into this. However, that doesn't justify changing copyright law in this regard. And secondly, the significant First Amendment issue. I mean, the prior restraint aspect of the decision, I think, has strong implications as well, that the decision ought to be overturned. I think it's pretty clear the Ninth Circuit will overturn the decision, notwithstanding the harm that Garcia felt. And I do feel sorry for his, you know, horrible facts, but did not justify the Ninth Circuit decision. But I think you're right, Stuart, that it's pretty clear signal that we're going to see that this won't have any lasting impact on our copyright jurisprudence.
All right. And this week in breaches, not a lot of breaches, but Anthem Blue Cross put a bunch of medical advice and data. It's not a classic breach. They seem to have had a program that was collating letters, and in the course of collating letters, put in the subject line all kinds of sensitive data about the tests people should be getting, and sent out emails to everybody. So if you read the subject line, you knew an awful lot about the medical status of the person. Jason, did they actually violate the law?
Well, it's an interesting question, you know, whether there's a breach when your personal information is disclosed to you. The emails in question were otherwise ordinary messages encouraging Anthem Blue Cross members, which is the Blue Cross of California, to get checkups and get preventive screenings. And although the body of the emails was normal, as you said, the subject lines included personal medical information like categories of age, or whether they were recommended for certain types of medical screening. It was a sort of list of tests with a wire and indicating whether those tests were ones that the member was encouraged to get. And, you know, there are a lot of hospital systems that are moving away from sending emails like this because there are so many risks with email and moving on to other forms of online access, like online secure portals that patients get access to get information like this. There may be a HIPAA problem, although it's not entirely clear without the facts. So you can make an argument that the disclosure was not made to an unauthorized person, but in fact was made to the patient.
No one would be surprised or upset if this was in the body of the email, right?
Well, that's right. I mean, you know, it's a thin read to base a HIPAA violation on if you say that it's in the subject line, which anybody could read if they happen to be looking over your shoulder at your phone. But if it was in the body of the email, they wouldn't be able to see it unless they had access sufficient to actually open the email. It may also be a reportable incident or may not under California breach notification law. We need more facts to analyze it properly. But, you know, this company has had problems with the California AG in the past. They had an incident in which they sent mailings out where you could see the Social Security number through the window in the envelope, and they had another incident where names and Social Security numbers were displayed in a document on the company's website. But that's different because those are easily accessible to people other than the person who owns the information. And so it'll be an interesting thing to see as more facts come out whether this truly does implicate HIPAA or state law.
It may just be something that is repeated endlessly in the next six negligence and breach claims made against them. So I have to say I don't ordinarily look to Argentina for policy guidance. They usually take, you know, Europe's bad ideas and turn them toxic, everything from Freudianism to, socialism. But the Argentina Supreme Court actually seems to have got this one right. Michael, can you tell us a little bit more about it?
Yeah, but I may not agree with your conclusion. The court here, in this case, denied the claims of a woman who was a model and whose name and pictures were used by or various sex-oriented websites. And she sued Google and Yahoo, saying they should have never linked to these websites in the first place, and also that they improperly failed to take down the links when she notified them that these sites had used her name and pictures for, you know, to sell sex, basically. The court in this part, I think, was correct. It said that Google and Yahoo have no obligation to put in filtering mechanisms to look for content like this and just keep it off their search engine results. But the part I thought was bizarre was it said that search engines do have an obligation to take down links if they get knowledge of copyright violation or some other illegal content through a court order, but that if a private party notifies them, they don't have to take down the links. That somehow doesn't give the site sufficient knowledge, unless it's a case involving gross and manifest harm. So if it involves something like child pornography or speech that endangers someone's life or grossly violates privacy. You know, I don't know what grossly violates privacy if it's not nude pictures of you that you didn't willingly put out there. So I thought that line that they drew between notification from a court and notification by a private party was a little strange.
Although, Mike, on that, I would say, you know, in some ways it makes sense in that, you know, if an internet company can gain knowledge through over the transom notice by any user, how they have a compliance program to deal with that is very difficult to see. You know, knowledge through a court order where you're sending it to someone with some legal sophistication seems to be a distinction worth a difference in that regard. The other part of
it's a little difficult to tell the court you want to ignore their orders too.
Right, right.
And yeah, but look, you know, but you know, in this country, in the DMC, the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, we do the same thing. If a private party can serve a takedown notice and have the content taken down, it doesn't require a court order.
Well, but it does have to go to a registered agent whose sole purpose is to receive DMCA takedown notices. And with regard to anything but copyright, we would say, at least in other civil issues, that Section 230 is essentially designed to protect the internet companies from gaining from liability through over the transom, you know, notices. And so I think it is worth, at least as a practical matter, it's a distinction that makes a huge difference from a compliance standpoint.
I don't know what difference a registered agent.
By my, go ahead.
I don't, you know, yes, we've drawn a distinction in our law between copyright, which we give favored status, and anything else. You know, your right not to be defamed or your right not to have private naked pictures of you put on the internet. That doesn't mean that makes sense. But also, I don't know what, you know, having a registered agent, how that serves as a protection. I mean, takedown notices get reviewed by websites. They have processes in place, and sometimes they reject them if they think, no, this content is actually not copyrighted. You could do the same thing for material that's not copyright but has some other unlawful aspect to it.
Well, except for this. In the DMCA, we're not asking the internet company to make any legal determination about the validity of the copyright. There is a whole process that's set up to do that. And in the criminal context, it's a little hard to see how over the transom notice would not result in requiring whoever in the legal department of the internet company would have to make some sort of calculation on whether they agree that link is linking to something that's illegal. In a child pornography situation, that's easy. But in other areas, it may not be so easy to do.
They do make determinations based on copyright, whether it's actually a violation of copyright. I just had a case last week where they made a determination that it was not copyrighted. So they're doing it.
All they're required to do under DMCA is just receive the notice and take it down if it's a valid notice. They don't actually have to determine whether they agree with that or not.
Well, I'm saying first of all, they do, and second of all, they have to determine if it's a valid notice. Well, how do you determine notice if it's got a signature? I mean, they make these determinations, so it's to say it's okay in copyright, but it's not necessary in other areas, is making a value judgment that I think is debatable, as we've just shown.
They may, but I think that's different than a law that requires them to make that determination. So you're not required to make any decision on whether the copyright is valid or not, or whether it's being put up pursuant to fair use. And then, of course, the DMCA creates a framework for the poster to challenge that, and essentially the Internet company is removed from the dispute at that point, and they let the two parties duke it out. I think in other areas, trying to ask the Internet company to make some distinction on whether that it's a legally valid claim, I think, is problematic, at least from a compliance standpoint.
But they do, when the poster contests the takedown notice, they do make a determination. They don't just say, okay, we give up. I mean, they're required to make a determination at that point.
No, they do put it back up if that's the case, and then the two parties can challenge it.
Danny, I think, accurately points out that Michael's essentially repeating the basic theory behind the right to be forgotten, which is, come on, you do it for copyright. You ought to do it for these poor people who want to forget their last mistress but one.
Yeah, but we're talking about a very different substantive standard. The right to be forgotten, you know, it's if the information is old, or in the determination of the search engine, whether it's just somehow not relevant. Now, that's different from determining whether content is unlawful.
Okay, fair enough. So let me turn to the other. Probably we could have put this in the category of the law behind the story, except the story was about the court proceeding. The EFF is boasting that they caught the government misrepresenting the facts or the law in the context of a national security letter disclosures. And I have to say, I had a lot of trouble figuring out exactly what the misrepresentation was. The government has filed a letter saying, yeah, we regret the error. So obviously they did say something wrong, and it clearly had to do with their statement that a recipient of an NSL could complain about the standards and the kinds of letters they were getting. Jason, what was it that the government got wrong?
So this is something that appears to have just been a government lawyer had a bad day in an oral argument, and now EFF and others are sort of piling on and trying to make more of what I think was an innocent misstatement than it deserves. But, you know, we've reported before on the lawsuit that EFF brought in 2011, challenging the constitutionality of NSLs and the gag orders, and back in March of last year, Judge Susan Ilston ruled against the government and held that the gag orders violated the First Amendment and ordered the government to stop issuing NSLs and to stop enforcing the gag provision of the statute, although that order was stayed pending appeal. So an oral argument last month under questioning about whether the gag order provisions stifle the First Amendment right to comment on government action, the government lawyer said that recipients could make comments about the quality of the NSLs received, and they could comment on the quantity received within certain bands. And the confusion came, I think, it appears, from the question of whether the rules were any different, or if you were in the 0 to 249 or 0 to 1,000 bands. You may recall, Michael has reported on this a number of times, that under the deal that was worked out with the government, or a provider could report whether they received between 0 and 249 national security processes of any kind, or 0 to 1,000 NSLs during a given period.
Oh, I see. So the argument was, if you were in the band of, say, 0 to something, right, the lowest band, you're not allowed to say whether you got any.
At all.
And so you could not say, if you were reporting that band, the NSLs we've gotten are irresponsible.
Exactly. Because the reason that they chose 0 and not 1 is to prevent you from commenting on whether you received any in the first place. But if you were in the higher band, you know, 1,000
you
and
can
up,
say anything you want.
Or you could at least, implicitly, you're acknowledging that you received at least one, right, or at least 250 or at least 1,000 because you're in that band. And then you would be freer to comment on the quality. And so the government immediately brought the error to the court's attention. It's not clear whether that was because they were prompted by EFF or did it on their own, but they brought it to the court's attention, apologized for it, explained what the source of the error was, and have now corrected the misstatement. So we'll await the Ninth Circuit's decision on the underlying appeal.
So it certainly sounds like the people who are saying, oh, the government lied, are getting this wrong. It's, it would have been a stupid thing to lie about. Okay. And last thing that I want to just briefly mention is that Google has now weighed in on a privacy issue dealing with the U.S. and European negotiations, which have been going on since I was in government, God help us, in which Europe has been complaining that the Privacy Act only applies to Americans, whereas their glorious rights of man data protection law applies to anyone, including Americans. So to make it even, the U.S. should modify the Privacy Act to allow Europeans and other human beings to bring claims under it. Problem is, the Privacy Act has been interpreted on the assumption that a lot of national security stuff can be talked about in the context of Americans that we wouldn't want to talk about in the context of foreign targets of intelligence gathering. So this would be a pretty heavy lift. Google has weighed in to say, we think you ought to do it. And obviously, they've got reasons to want the Europeans to be happier with them. They also have reasons to want the disputes over privacy and Snowden to be toned down. The administration has said, yeah, we're prepared to do that with appropriate safeguards, and Google is pushing everybody to do this. That's my understanding. I have to say I have some skepticism about doing this as a unilateral American act. I made many concessions to European sensibilities in the PNR discussions, which they immediately pocketed and started complaining again about other things. So the idea that we can make them happy just doing this one thing is dubious. We really need to ask the question, what is it that they're going to do for us if we do this for them? And that has yet to enter into the policy debate, at least on the Hill. I think it probably ought to. If you're going to negotiate, you need to know what you're getting. And I'm not sure we're getting anything from making this change.
There is an ongoing negotiation between the EU and the United States on the safe harbor protections. There are 13 categories of things that are on the table for negotiation. 11 of them have been negotiated out. One of them happens to be this very question.
Yeah, but this is BS that we have never discussed in the context of the safe harbor what U.S. government policies are going to be about handling data of individuals, nor have we asked the Europeans, as we could have, how good are your protections for us against your government's snooping in Americans' affairs. They're terrible.
That may all be true. The question you laid on the table was, what are we going to get in exchange for this? And the question is, if we're able to do this, then it takes some degree of pressure off of the current request.
I quite agree. But their strategy is, I'm going to reach across and take Danny's iPhone and then say, I'll give it back to you if you'll give me something. They're saying, we want to take back the safe harbor deal on some bogus theory that somehow we get to talk about government relations to individuals. And if you don't give us this new bogus theory and a new concession, we're going to take back something we've already negotiated with you. That's really what the safe harbor discussion is about.
Well, that's an interesting perspective. But the safe harbor, it wasn't negotiated in perpetuity. It wasn't, we agreed to a safe harbor. There will be a safe harbor for the rest of history.
Right.
I mean, at the end of the day, large countries and governments have these sorts of negotiations where you revisit questions and you have exchanges of ideas.
Yeah, but if they're going to if they want to put the safe harbor at risk, they have to recognize that their entire legal theory for restricting data flows is at risk. The only reason that they can restrict data flows, which is clearly a restraint of international trade, is they say, but the data will be subject to a new law when it leaves our shores. The point of the safe harbor was to say, no, we'll continue to observe European principles with respect to this data when it leaves Europe, and to give you essentially the equivalent of European law even as it's processed in the United States. But in the meantime, the Europeans have asserted that they can follow that data and continue to impose their law on it anyway once it leaves Europe. If that's their theory, then they have no justification for doing that plus putting a data boycott on inadequate jurisdictions. At least that we should be looking for ways of challenging their attack on the safe harbor.
Well, I also think, Stuart, I mean, that's an excellent point, that the conversation between Europe and the United States, we have to, and the U.S., I think, has done a very good job of respecting their framework that they bring to these issues. They have a different framework on privacy, where they look at it through the lens of a human right, where we really look at privacy through a tort lens. The same is true with free speech. They regulate speech, and they have valid traditions for doing that, and we do not. But I think the Europeans could do better in understanding the framework we bring to these issues and the philosophy we bring to these issues, rather than saying that we just have to adopt their view of these issues. And we could do a better job, I think, of trying to help Europe respect our legal traditions.
But yeah, this is going to be an ongoing and longer conversation with the Europeans.
Yeah. My favorite exchange was with the Europeans over this was after a long discussion about their standards for what makes for adequate data protection requirements indistinguishable from their law. I said, take it from me, it never really feels like imperialism from the inside. Let's jump to the ITU. Speaking of imperialism, Danny, what is the ITU? You just got back from 3 weeks in Busan talking about the future of the ITU. There's all kinds of occasional hand waving about what it means for the United States and the internet. What did you conclude was actually happening at the ITU, and how is it going to affect us?
Sure. Well, the ITU is the International Telecommunications Union, and it's a specialized agency of the United Nations. It's 150 years old. It was created, it was originally the International Telegraph Movement. And then as it migrated from communications, it came on to take significant responsibilities in the area of wireless communications with global allocations of spectrum. It has three branches, radio development and technology standards, telecommunication standards. And in the development sector, it essentially is a share of best practices and information for policymakers and lawmakers around the world, particularly in the developing world, for creating a legal regulatory environment that encourages investment and connectivity. And in the telecom standards section, it creates voluntary standards for the interconnection of telecommunication systems around the world. So it was a largely by regular people ignored agency up until probably two or three years ago when we had the wicked divide in Dubai over the International Telecommunications Union.
Prior to that, it had been mostly about sort of enforcing rates and making sure that the international telephone rates were enforced on both sides of the transaction.
It created parameters under which you would negotiate what those rates would be. And then the question becomes, should the ITU play a similar role in the internet infrastructure and internet communications? And our answer to that is no. Not because there's something immoral about the ITU or because there's something wrong with the direction of the ITU, but because it isn't necessary and it wouldn't work. It doesn't adapt to the internet protocol world. And there are multiple functional institutions that allow for the functional communication and existence of critical internet resources. ICANN is the most obvious one. I think we're going to talk about that a little bit later. But the ITU does play a vital and critical role in any number of different areas. So, for example, the digital transition in spectrum, getting broadcast.
Getting everybody to move to TCP/IP for communications over the air. Yep.
And the hope there is that over time, if you're able to free up enough mobile broadband communication space in the airwaves around the world and create a legal and regulatory environment that encourages competition and doesn't protect incumbents in different parts of the world, you can drive down the price of access for people in those parts of the world where you have 16-17% access in Africa, or you have 20-21% in Latin America and in Southeast Asia. We really need to drive those numbers up in order to grow the economies of scale necessary to really build on our vision that's underlying.
Well, it's not like we lack for people who are enthusiastic about that, right? Google and Facebook are both launching sky-based communication system designed to get the last billion online, right?
Well, yeah, but there are more than a billion left. There are probably 3 billion people connected now, 3 to 4 billion people connected.
Okay,
so leaves you with another 3 to
go. Okay.
Right? 2 billion of those people live on less than $2 a day. So the question is not only how do you build this infrastructure, but how do you provide it at a price point that
right.
is usable to a person with that little money.
Danny, what would you say about, you know, some within the ITU framework, some governments want the ITU to also focus not just on these interconnection issues, but really on content-related issues.
Right.
And given the importance of the Internet, but also the importance of legitimate interests of governments relative to the content on the Internet, should governments through the ITU have a greater role in Internet governance specifically related to content?
It's our position that the answer to that question is absolutely not. And what I just came from is called the ITU Plenipotentiary. It happens every 4 years. And the ITU debates its constitution and conventions, which are the legally binding documents, and its legal authority under those two documents, plus hundreds of resolutions for what the work will be for the next 4 years. So we successfully argued against any change to the constitution and conventions, therefore no legal expansion into content and what we've been saying is what the ITU does is connect people to networks, not govern what they do with those networks, whether what they create, what they say, how they interact with each other, that there are other institutions for that purpose, both multilateral and multi-stakeholder. So, for example, the UN Human Rights Commission right now is debating questions of privacy.
Right.
Writ large, UNESCO debates questions of culture and the digital economy, and then we have multiple different regional institutions that do all these.
Isn't the danger if we don't allow the ITU to help come up with norms relative to content on the internet that you'll have countries that will just unilaterally impose those and will trend toward a balkanization of the internet if we don't give those countries a voice within the ITU?
I think to some degree there's some misconception about the balkanization of the internet with the balkanization of the World Wide Web or the balkanization of any given service provided over the World Wide Web. It's not the same thing. The protocols that make up the internet and connect networks to each other is the same protocol everywhere in the world, right? A true balkanization of the internet would be a country like Russia or a country like Iran or a country like China saying, no, we're going to create an intranet. It will have its own protocols. Machines will communicate with each other in their own way. They will have their own addressing and directory system. And it may or may not connect with a larger world's internet. That you don't see really happening on any scale. Right? It's not intelligent. There's no inherent self-interest in doing that. What you do see happening is, so for example, Turkey took down Twitter. Right. And Turkey took down Twitter during the last election because they have domestic laws that they felt were being violated by Twitter. Now, Turkey's own Supreme Court decided that their interpretation of that was incorrect and Twitter's back up. But at the end of the day, what you're seeing is varying degrees of freedom of ability to use and access applications, of which email and the internet and search and other things are, which are that ride over the internet. They're not the internet itself. Right. And then the question becomes, what are the best mechanisms for either establishing de facto or de jure norms for how the platform providers interact with the legal entities in those countries where you have a global platform and that global platform can't operate the way it does everywhere else in that country for legal reasons. And that's an ongoing struggle that, you know, our friends in the technology community deal with really largely without us. I mean, to the degree that they need our help, we will step in and provide some degree of brokering ability, but we don't.
So what is
they work it out themselves, essentially.
What is it that the countries that want more control think they can do or would like to be able to be empowered to do by the ITU that they can't do with local law?
So there's actually, we just had to defeat an Indian proposal at the ITU, and the Indian proposal said this, that the ITU should take over the routing functions of the internet, as well as enforcing standards, technical standards, by which you would allow for tracing and tracking of all internet protocol-based communications. And essentially their argument was if the communications on the internet originates in a country and it terminates in that country, then it should never leave the country.
Okay.
And they want the ITU to make sure that that happens through technical standards.
So they both want to make sure that stuff stays inside, internal to their country, and that it is identifiable back to source?
To a specific, yes, to a specific person. And so that, and that comes from a history of having worked as a communications regulator,
right,
where that, you know, that's possible on a telephone system.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And they want to apply that same authority to the internet. And it comes with very heavy costs for efficiency and for the operations of the internet and the voluntary nature of it. And also the voluntary structure of protocols and routing decisions made on the basis of efficiency. So what their concern is a law enforcement concern. It's not a communications concern.
Well, and an espionage concern. They're afraid if it leaves their, if the communication leaves India, that if it goes through Pakistan, the Pakistanis will listen to it.
Sure. But, and by the way, our U.S. government has had proposals to require that all internet communications that start within the United States stay within the United States, or at least route through a U.S. server. And, you know, it'll be interesting in that, as, you know, within the United States, there's also proposals, for instance, in the internet gambling context, to say that for an internet gambling operation to be lawful, the communication has to start within a state and end within the state, the user and the server.
It's like New Hampshire.
It does. And query how that can happen when it's very hard to control
that's
whether that
possible
communication goes outside the state. So it is an issue that we struggle with even in the United States.
So oddly, this is Snowden fallout in some respects. It wasn't served up that way.
It was never mentioned,
oh,
right? And I mean, there's some degree of diplomatic niceties in that situation. But, you know, I mean, a lot of these countries are in very dangerous parts of the world, and,
right,
and what they're talking about are law enforcement and war concerns, and those are just simply not the jurisdiction of the ITU, right? There are, if the nations of the world through the UN or some other system came to a decision that this was something that was necessary and then directed either the existing voluntary organizations that manage the critical infrastructure to achieve a specific end, then possibly you could think about, well, how do you go about doing that? But it should not originate out of communications ministers from around the world gathered at the ITU. Our job is to facilitate connectivity, not to control it.
So I'll grant you that on the question of keeping communications inside national boundaries, but I recognize that, recognizing the controversy, the fact is we've got a cybersecurity crisis, and identifying the attackers is a critical part of deterring the attacks. And the ITU or someone, but given their standards and other regulatory authority, the ITU could play a significant role in fostering the development of standards that would make it more easy to identify people who are violating, who are breaking into computers or sending spam.
Maybe, but not as a sole end, and not by themselves, and not without direction.
Yeah, and I'll disagree with that, Stuart, in that I really think that argument is a compelling argument, and is the argument that those countries that want the ITU to play a greater role in internet governance will make as a way to get the camel's nose under the tent.
Yeah, that I agree, and I'm dubious about the ITU because its history is not particularly favorably disposed toward efficiency or innovation. But you need to appreciate the power of the argument, and it's not an argument that lacks power, especially if you don't get the benefits of the innovation, you don't have any industry in your country, and you are suffering from cybercrime.
You know what, that's actually, I think, the most critical point, is that for most of the people, nations that are upset about how the internet is governed and acts, because they're consumers rather than producers in a market. And where people are happy with how the internet works is because the internet is there, right? So Australia, Japan, Europe, it's not cultural, it's not economic, it's on the basis of whether or not you have access to this service. And as we see it proliferate in other countries, you see people move from a hardline, supportive multilateral system to moving and shifting towards a supportive multi-stakeholder system as more stakeholders are actually created within their country, right? And it's been a fascinating learning experience for me. It's so vastly different than having worked in the United States Senate. And actually, I have very much enjoyed it. I've grown to respect my colleagues immensely from around the world that work at the ITU, that I interact with on a regular basis. And we interact now in multiple different fora. So I'll see them at ICANN or I'll see them at the IGF. And there's this whole community that has been created and this revolving calendar of events where you're seeing the same people in different parts of the world all the time.
Yeah, well, it has this in common with immigration. It seems to be an eternal negotiation that never actually arrives at a destination.
So speaking of one unwieldy organization potentially, you've mentioned another potentially unwieldy organization, ICANN. And ICANN has created some controversy, especially relative to intellectual property owners over their new rollout of GTLDs and relative to trademarks, which tend to be a local issue, trademarks geographically regional. Yet we have some pretty high-profile disputes. And one that I was fascinated with was the dispute between Amazon.com, the big U.S. major corporation, and the Latin American countries that have a understandable interest in not having Amazon.com, a U.S. company, control a GTLD for the Amazon River and the Amazon Basin. Can you talk a little bit about how the U.S. government interacts in those issues and whether they do take a position that supports U.S. or the Latin American, how that happens?
Sure. This is largely the Department of Commerce's jurisdiction, but we work with them very closely on this, so I'll speak to the degree that I can. We sit, the United States sits on the Government Advisory Committee to the board of ICANN. Right. There were a series in the rolling out of this new GTLD program, which basically meant that you were going to create a dot, almost anything you can think of, in order to compete with the existing .com, .orgs, etc. There were a series of proposals that were geographically based, or the word was had a geographic component, and there is a list of geographically based names that the UN has that was cross-referenced in the rules of application for the GTLD that did not include the Amazon. It includes all kinds of things like a city, a country.
Champagne.
It doesn't actually include champagne. And that's a separate conversation which we can have later. But what it came down to was that in this particular situation, the Latin Americans felt like, well, this is an identifiable geography. We know what it is. We value it culturally. And we would prefer that you not delegate it as a dot Amazon. Everyone in the world, all the countries of the Governmental Advisory Committee, agreed with the Latin Americans except for the United States. And we held up the approval, or the what the Government Advisory Committee does is provide advice to the board saying do or do not approve a given GTLD. And if the board decides not to go with GAC advice, it creates all kinds of problems, but you have to have a negotiation, blah, blah, blah. So we bought both the company and the country's time to negotiate and discuss. And they did. They had many meetings, and they weren't able to reach an amicable conclusion. And then the question became, does the United States stand alone between the Government Advisory Committee and the board, the Government Advisory Committee providing a communication to the board and saying this is what we do? We decided not to. We took a position of neutrality on the underlying question and let the Government Advisory Committee go forward with their proposal to the board. We believe that hopefully this will be resolved going forward in some amicable way between Amazon and the nations involved. There's an Amazon.com. It's not a problem. So creating a dot
Amazon. This wouldn't be hard to solve. You could have dot Rio Amazon and dot Amazon Inc. And leave dot Amazon out of it, and you would have.
Well, those were two ideas that actually occurred to people, and neither was acceptable to either party. So, I mean, these things will take time. The internet's not going away, you know.
So the risk here, I suppose, is that you'll start getting scams in which you get notification that your goods are going to be delivered. You just have to make one last payment, and the message will come from so and so at blank.amazon, right? So the real risk is that somehow this .amazon account or the GTLD will be used to lead people to believe they're dealing with Amazon, the company.
Except there isn't going to be a .amazon. At this point, no one gets it.
No one gets it. So that's the plan. Yeah. So everybody has said, we'd rather no one use Amazon.
For a GTLD.
Yes. Okay.
But Amazon bid on a bunch of other dot what, like I think they got dot books.
Well, and they're going to invest in some GTLD, and once they've invested
in a number of them,
they will not be interested in the other except to make sure it stays on the shelf.
By the way, query whether these GTLDs actually are a commercial success or not. You know, we are running out of dot to the right of the dot, but ICANN has tried to do some other top-level domains like dot info and and right. others.
And they have not been big successes.
They're not big successes. So I think in some ways the tempest from the rights holders about the trademark concerns are a bit of a tempest in a teapot.
Well, except that they probably feel they have to buy them.
Well, certainly there's going to be a defensive measure that they're worried about and defensive protection of their marks. But whether the ICANN proposal is a success or not, I think is still to be determined.
But ICANN is a fascinating institution. Unlike the ITU, which is 150 years old, ICANN is, I think, 15. So it's still going through a series of growing pains, I guess. And it's a work in progress. But it really is, to me, it's been fascinating to walk into that institution and see how a disparate group of really non-particularly enfranchised individuals work together to come to some kind of conclusion about how this massive system works, right? It's very voluntary. It's very bottom-up. It's very small-d democratic. I mean, not wholly egalitarian, because there is some degree of elitism in the way that people's views are judged, but it is totally different than, say, the ITU, where I walk in and I'm the only American who can speak.
Right. And that's the what's interesting is there's obviously still unhappiness with the residual American role, and ICANN, the contract, and is the proposal that the alternative to that to have ITU take over ICANN's functions?
That's not our proposal.
No, of course not.
But the Russians and others have proposed that in the past. It's been beaten every time. They didn't even bother proposing it this time at the last plenipotentiary. That's not really a risk. The question becomes, and the question that the community is trying to ask itself now is, can you effectively remove the contractual obligation between ICANN and the NTIA and have ICANN functionally govern itself, be responsible to the people for whom it carries out its functions, and just do so under a non-contractual obligatory system?
Let me take you back to the ITU, because from what I've heard, and confirm that here. Busan was a very big success strategically for the U.S. Nothing bad happened, which is always good in this area, because nothing happening probably allows the private sector to get on with it. And it doesn't sound as though there's a resolution that really is a cloud on the horizon, a serious cloud on the horizon. So we may actually be looking at 4 years where the ITU as a regulator of the internet is a receding threat. That's not what it looked like when the meeting in the Persian Gulf was held. What changed other than brilliant leadership?
Sure, of course. You know, to some degree, you don't want to toot your own horn. There are a lot of people who are writing about what happened in Busan, and I think there's a general consensus that it was very successful. For the United States, there were, going into Busan, there were a number of proposals on internet-related resolutions. There were a number of proposals to insert the words privacy and cybersecurity into resolutions of work for the ITU. All of them were defeated. And what happened was we did a very strong and concerted job of working with our region in the first instance. So we lined up the Americas. We knew where we were. We made our deals within the Americas before ever going to Busan. And when you get to Busan, you have the Americas united. You have Europe united in even in a better place than we wanted, than the Americas were, and where we would really like eventually for everyone to be. But the Americas in a very good place. Africa relatively quiet.
Yep.
So it isolated the Russians and the Arabs, which were the ones who were coming in with very bad proposals. And so at the end of the day, you know, not only did not only did nothing bad happen. Beyond that, the U.S. as an active and engaged player within the ITU was rewarded for being that way. And, you know, we had 22 more votes for the ITU Council, which is what governs the ITU in between plenipotentiaries, than we did 4 years ago, with Snowden and everything in between. We had the ITU Council will be vice-chaired by an American, my deputy, in 2015, and chaired by her in 2016 for the first time in many, many, many years. We have done, it's all relationships. At the end of the day, it was all relationship building over the last 2 years and getting to a place where you can sit down and have a disagreement with someone you know, because I've been traveling the world and getting to know these people for 2 years, and it's an honorable and functional disagreement. You can like you can with a good friend on the other side of the aisle.
Mm-hmm.
And then you come to your determinations about, well, what is possible, what is doable, and how can we work together to achieve whatever you need in a different venue. Or in a different way, right? Because we are not anti your ideas or your goals. We just don't think this is the right institution by which to implement whatever particular solution you're trying to find. You think that these are the other institutions where work is ongoing. And we are, oftentimes, I was able to have Tom Wheeler came with me, Larry Strickland came with me, and Assistant Secretary Andy Osmond from DHS came with me. And we had a full team. And when we were sitting across the table from communications minister and their foreign relations person, they didn't know that DHS was doing work in their country with their equivalent of a DHS, or that our DOD was doing work in their country with their equivalent of a DOD on the very problems that they were bringing to the ITU. So it's both a combination of information sharing and empowering of a nation as opposed to an individual on questions that you have about a particular issue that was able to bring us along. And also just a lot of listening and a lot of going to people in their home turf and talking to them and getting to know them. And I'm very, very proud of the work that our entire team did, and I'm very, very happy with the outcome.
No, it does sound like a great outcome. One last question that just occurs to me. You know, the president and to some extent Tom Wheeler have said, you know, Article 2 is a plausible basis for regulating open internet, net neutrality. But the idea of bringing that kind of regulatory power to bear on the internet sounds a little inconsistent with the U.S. government's position at the ITU, and I'm sure you had to think about how you're going to square that up. What did you say when people said, well, you know, you're regulating the internet?
Well, what's interesting is nobody said that. Not the Russians, not the Chinese, nobody, right? And there is network neutrality law in Brazil. There's network neutrality law in Chile, and it's passed a body within Europe. Nobody argued that, oh, because you have these laws in your countries, therefore you can't come here and argue against international regulation of the internet. Okay, so nobody outside of this country is making the argument that
people are making it in this country. This is
as a tactical matter. Yeah. Yes,
but I don't think anyone truly believes that. In that, you know, the Title II jurisdiction and the regulation of ISPs isn't regulation of the internet. It's regulation of the access to the internet. And countries have always regulated those access points and access to the internet. I have a question just on, so speaking of sort of the other side of the aisle, if the new Congress tries to stop the transfer of the INET contract, how difficult does that make your job in dealing with other countries?
The tone and the respect or lack thereof that would be shown to the interests and equities of others abroad would hurt. But let's remember that the INA contract was not created by an act of Congress. Right? At the end of the day, and really as a general rule, people whose living depends on the internet support this transition. Right? There's a lot of politics being played with these issues. But at the end of the day, obviously, you know, I would come from Congress. I have an immense amount of respect for congressional oversight, and we'll be working very closely with them. And what I hope to see is that once the community comes around a specific proposal, that the community will sell it to everyone, including our colleagues on the Hill. It won't be just our responsibility. We are part of the community in that sense. But then I want to go back just real quickly to the Title II question, because the theme that somehow network neutrality regulation is regulation of the internet is, again, just not correct. It doesn't affect network protocols. It doesn't affect engineering. What it affects is the last mile broadband service providers market relationship to you and to everyone else on the internet. And what we've been doing going around the world is ensuring that no single actor in this space can control outcomes for anyone else, or can inhibit speech, or can inhibit commerce in a manner that's discriminatory and unfair, right? I mean, there are governments trying to do that. We're trying to stop them from doing that. There are other actors who want to favor their incumbent companies by doing that. So the idea that we're going to preserve the neutrality of the network or the neutrality of the broadband service provider relative to everyone else on the network is wholly consistent with what we've been doing internationally. And, you know, I think some people were surprised by the president's video. I was not. I sat next to the president when he was a senator for less than a year and gave his first podcast. His first podcast was on network neutrality.
Right? Well, he's always welcome
exactly
on ours.
The same thing. You know, I mean, it's been many, many years. This isn't a new conversation. This isn't a new issue. So, you know, I'm excited. I'm actually excited about this. You know, I'm happy to see my president stand up and make a clear and strong statement on behalf of what I think is the right place to be in terms of public policy. And we'll see how it plays out.
Great. Danny, thank you so much, or Mr. Ambassador, excuse me. You're a great advocate for your view and for the country. Thank you, Markham Erickson, Michael Vattis, Jason Weinstein. Before we sign off, we do like to give everybody an opportunity to plug any upcoming speaking engagements you might have, anything that you'd like to advertise.
Sure. I'm actually going to the Council on Foreign Relations on Thursday.
Good.
The 20th is, I believe, Thursday morning. And they're going to have actually a panel of folks from other countries, Brazil and elsewhere, to talk about what their views are of internet governance going forward. Then myself, Larry Strickling, and Chris Painter will talk about the American views as well. It should be a very good event. I'm pretty excited about it.
Yeah, that's great. Markham, anything?
Nothing on the near-term horizon.
And I want to thank both of you. I've known both of you for a very long time. I appreciate your service. And I look forward to future conversations.
It's a pleasure. And next week, you should come to the Shakespeare Theater. I have a big defense, actually a prosecution. I am joining one of my other partners, Pantelis Michalopoulos, in the prosecution of Lysistrata. We will be taking the play as the record and arguing in front of Judge Alito and Judge Kaufman, at least Judge Alito, Judge Brett Kavanaugh, and one other judge whom I've now misplaced. And we will be arguing that her campaign to deny sexual favors to all of Athens until they reached a peace agreement with Sparta included violations of the Law of Nations, treason against Athens, and misprision of the judicial process. So I fear we're doomed. Since the Women's Bar Association has already bought a block of tickets. But nonetheless, it should be entertaining for everybody. And I'm also talking to HHS about cybersecurity, which will on which I'm more knowledgeable but less entertaining. And as a reminder, the Cyber Law Podcast is open to feedback. Send your questions, suggestions for interview candidates or topics to cyberlawpodcast@steptoe.com. And if you'd like to leave us a message, we promise to play the most entertainingly abusive on the air. Contact us at 1-202-862-5785. This has been episode 43 of the Steptoe Cyber Law Podcast, brought to you by Steptoe & Johnson. Next week, we'll have as our guest commentator, Sal Stolfo from the Columbia Computer Science Department and from Allure Software. He's got a very interesting new technology. And we hope you'll join us as we once again provide insights into the latest events in technology, security, privacy, and government.